Now.
We got them coming in. We got 20. We already got a question.
All right.
And it's Doug. All right. Good morning, everybody. It's what day is it? It is November 14th, 2021. This is Paradox's class with Hugh Ross, astronomer extraordinaire. And Hugh, we're going to go for the first 15 minutes. We'll do Q&A, and then Hugh will do his lesson. And then at the end of the lesson, we'll do Q&A again. So for kind of an extended Q&A. So Hugh, would you want to pray us in? Or
sure, I'll open us up. Thank you, Father, for this time that we can have today on this your day. And Father, I pray that you would grant all of us grace, humility, and wisdom, that we may receive more of your love, your life, and your truth. And Father, I pray too that you would be equipping us to be messengers where we can take the good news of salvation through what you did in the cosmos and what you revealed in your book, the Bible, to all the people, groups of the world. In Jesus' name, amen.
So, well, any announcements, Hugh, or do you want to just
dive right into the questions? I got a discovery and a talk that we're going to do as part of today. I'll talk about that when we get to the teaching time.
Awesome. Okay. Well, we'll go to the first question. Doug McComb, street evangelist here in Southern California. He says, I asked this question as a complete layman when it comes to quantum version of classical dynamics. String theory posits very small strings. Those various modes of vibration produce the observed particles and forces of nature, often described through analogies with music, especially Pythagorean harmonies. Is there really a tangible link between music and string theory?
Well, there's definitely a tangible link between music and mathematics. I mean, one way you can identify composers of classical music is look for the mathematical patterns in their music. So that's how I identify them anyway. So, and I had a lot of friends that majored both in mathematics and in music because of the consonance between the two disciplines. So, string theory is one of many theories to explain the creation of particles. And I wrote about string theory in chapter 3 of Beyond the Cosmos, the third edition. It's got the latest update on string theory. What is now a consensus amongst particle physicists is that in order to explain the fundamental particles that we see and their properties, the universe must be comprised of three large dimensions of space and six very tiny dimensions of space. And string theory is probably the most popular of those particle creation models that talks about how particles behave in nine dimensions of space. And the context is that God creates the universe with nine dimensions of space that all expand from the cosmic creation event, but that when the force of gravity separates out from the other three forces of physics, that's the first force separation event that happens in the history of the universe. That takes place when the universe is 10 to the minus 43 seconds old, that when that happens, six of the nine dimensions stop expanding. So those six dimensions today are extremely tiny. You say, how tiny? They measure 20 orders of magnitude smaller than the diameter of an electron, which explains why physicists really haven't noticed them until a couple of decades ago. But it does explain how particles behave. And yeah, there's a certain elegance in the particles that I think causes people to think about mathematics and music. I mean, to me, what's really amazing about this is that when you look at this, these nine-dimensional models, in six dimensions of space, within six tiny dimensions of space, you can have black holes with zero mass. Impossible in three large dimensions, but it's possible in the six tiny dimensions.
Thank you. J.A. Mosso says, hello, everybody. Quick question regarding the discovery of water in some other places. I've seen some commentaries on social media or even between colleagues that assert that in the enormous universe we live in, it is very plausible that other life forms exist, either in our galaxy or in others. What is your take on that? Could that be actually possible?
Yeah, those also, statements. Yeah, go ahead.
This is also, what is your take on supposed little green men?
Okay. Well, these claims are based on looking only at the liquid water planetary habitable zone. The assumption that if a planet is sufficient at the right distance from its host star, where liquid water could conceivably exist on its surface, then that planet would be a candidate to host life. But what you'll see in my Today's New Reasons to Believe articles that I've been posting at reasons.org, that's just one of 13 known planetary habitable zones. And for a planet to be truly habitable, it must simultaneously reside in all 13 of those planetary habitable zones. And so far, we know of only one planet out of the nearly 5,000 have been discovered for which that is true. And, you know, viewers get just one guess as to which planet that is. And actually, we've yet to find one planet beyond planet Earth that resides in even three of those 13, let alone all 13. Probably the other habitable zone that's received the most attention in the scientific literature is the ultraviolet habitable zone, how the planet likewise must be at the appropriate distance from the host star, where it gets just the right amount of ultraviolet radiation at just the right frequencies. Too short of a frequency is deadly for life, but the long frequency ultraviolet radiation is crucial for certain life essential biochemical reactions. But too much will kill you, too little will also mean you won't exist. And, it's really rare for a planet to simultaneously reside in both the ultraviolet and the liquid water habitable zone. Of all the stars that exist out there, only 3% would have the possibility of a planet orbiting them where the planet would simultaneously reside in both the liquid water and ultraviolet habitable zone. So 97% of all known stars are eliminated from contention. And of course, even if they are in contention, their planet has to orbit at just the right distance, and the star has to have just the right ultraviolet emission characteristics. So even if you only look at two, we discover that the possibility is remote that we're going to find another body with the capacity to support life. And hey, if you go back into the archive of a Paradoxes classes, I think it was a few months ago, and you'll find this at paradoxes.org. That's where we archive the video recordings of all the classes. But there was one episode where he talked about the latest habitable zone discovery, the fact that you have to have a planet-moon system where both the planet and the moon early in its history has a magnetosphere, not just a liquid iron core, but an actual magnetosphere, and where the two bodies have to be close enough together that the magnetospheres couple. And it takes a coupled magnetosphere to prevent the young star from sputtering away all the water and atmosphere on the planet. So that's number 14 that's been added to the list of habitable zones that are necessary for a planet to be really habitable. And by the way, those are just the planetary habitable zones. There's also the galactic habitable zones and the galactic cluster habitable zones. I write about all those habitability requirements in my next book that's coming out called Design to the Core. A good question. Thanks.
Great. So Mark Durham is next. Do you have any information regarding the claim of the newly discovered Chinese found hominid known as Homo longi or Dragon Man?
Yeah, I've heard about it. I've not really read much about it. I do know that Faisal Rana is on top of it, so he'd be the guy to contact. But this is not in any way a challenge to the reasons to believe human origins model. It's another example, as Fuzz points out, where every new hominid discovery sends the naturalistic model into greater chaos rather than lesser chaos. But he would have the details on that. I saw the announcement, briefly looked at it, but it went out of my mind because I knew Fuzz was on top of it.
Okay. Probably good time for one more. Tini Washington. She asks, how literally do you take commands of Jesus in the Gospels and know how far to take it? For example, don't call anyone on earth your father or teacher. I saw a video on this one time.
Did? Well, maybe you should be the one that answers it then.
Well, the video was that it was a sin to call anybody your dad. So that we're all. So I didn't really understand it myself. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, I usually that question comes up in the context of Roman Catholicism, because they take certain individuals in the church and they call them saints. But if you look at what you see in the New Testament epistles, you got both Peter and Paul making the point that every follower of Jesus Christ is a saint. And therefore, we shouldn't be elevating one member of the body of Christ above another member. I think that's the context there. It says, people have been saying, Hugh, should you really let people call you a doctor? Well, it is true that I have a PhD, but I let people call me Hugh. The joke in my family is that the only person that ever refers to me as Dr. Ross is my mother. She's passed away, but she was very proud of me getting the PhD. So instead of calling me Huey, she called me Dr. Ross. So, don't make a big deal out of titles. And, don't string too many letters after your name. So.
All right. Doug McCone has a follow-up question to his string theory one. Follow-up question, so is music possibly manifested in a beautiful way?
Music is that, we human beings, I mean, we're not the only animal that engages in music. You've got birds that do that. They sing songs. Whales sing songs. But what's unique about humans is we appreciate the beauty of music. We have the capacity to see beauty. I mean, for example, you hike in these beautiful national parks. I don't think the animals have any appreciation of the beauty of the park that they're wandering around in. To them, it's just a place where they can take care of themselves. But we humans walk through it and we notice the elegance and the beauty of the scene that we see before us. And we can tell when something is more beautiful than other things. Mathematicians have jumped in and said, when humans perceive symmetry, they see beauty and elegance. And I've seen that with my fellow astronomers, that when you look at a spiral galaxy that's got exceptionally symmetrical spiral arms, they see an enhanced beauty in that symmetry. And I think that makes sense. The symmetry is always a design feature. And so, I think we see that too in God's creatures, where we do see bilateral symmetry. Or where we see other mathematical forms of symmetry, we see that as an expression of beauty. Likewise with the colors, the odors, where all of our senses get involved. I think that enhances our appreciation of beauty. But it raises a question. Why do we human beings are able to see beauty and appreciate beauty? I mean, it has no benefit for survival of the fittest, yet we do possess this feature. But as the Bible says, we humans are created in the image of God. And just like God has a capacity to create beauty and appreciate beauty, likewise, we humans have the capacity to create beauty and appreciate beauty. And I think what really works best for us is we're involved in both. So I always encourage people, hey, I mean, for example, both of my sons are really into music. But what they've noticed is there's an enhancement of their appreciation of music when they're not only listening to it, but they're also involved in composition. And just, you know, they're not great composers, but the fact that they're trying gives them a greater appreciation for really elegant, beautiful music that is composed by real professionals.
I'm wondering if he's also asking, do you think music might possibly be string theory manifested in a beautiful way? Because I know I play guitar and it's like string theory.
No, that's a different kind of string theory. It kind of reminds me of a cartoon I once saw, which had these cats reading a book on quantum theory and the strings. And one cat says to the other, I had no idea that strings were such complex physical phenomena. I just was wanting to know why they're so much fun to play with. So, but you're talking about a different kind of strings on a guitar. Yeah. So,
my wife, the cat lover, is giggling over on the side here.
So. Right. Yeah, right. Strings. Cats really like to get into string theory, don't they?
They do. Well, Hugh, it's 10:46. Do you want to start your lesson?
Yeah, we'll jump into the teaching time. And for those of you that are new, kind of how we run the Paradoxes class, and you know, we're going to be changing it up in the future. But I've been alternating every second week, talk about a new scientific discovery, then move into our lesson on dual revelation. Then the following week, we don't talk about a scientific discovery and jump straight in to the lesson that we're working on. And we're getting really close to being able to go from only virtual meetings for the Paradoxes class. We're going to start up in-person meetings. You know, think restrictions have been much more harsh here in California. We're at a point now where it looks like we got the equipment up and running. So we're going to make an announcement soon when we'll return to in-person meetings. But just like when we had the in-person meetings before the pandemic, we were live streaming. We're going to continue the live streaming, and our hope is to upgrade the quality of the live streaming. So all of you that have been live streaming, you're still going to be able to participate, ask questions. In fact, I think we're going to be able to give you a much superior experience where we'll be able to bring you in via video for the questions that you ask. So that's coming, and it's coming relatively soon. And we're also going to change the time. You know, the church where I serve as a pastor has asked us if we could move the Paradoxes class to a lunch hour Pacific time. So instead of starting at 10:30, we're going to be starting at 1:15 p.m. And that's also done to accommodate the people in Asia that want to participate in the class. That means they'll be getting up at 6 a.m. in the morning instead of, you know, 3 or 4 in the morning. And it'll still be early enough for people in Europe that want to participate. It'll be a little later in the evening for them, but hopefully everybody won't be disturbing people's sleep patterns too much. So that's coming. So, but today's one of those weeks where we talk about a new scientific discovery. And what I'm going to be doing this week is, let me get my computer here set up. I forgot to do that. That's one thing I'm looking forward to, is that when we do the in-person meetings, I'm going to be able to go back to actually running this class with one computer instead of two computers. Sometimes I get out of sync between the two computers that I'm using here. But with that, let me share a screen so that you can all see my visuals. Okay, this is a standard first slide I use every Sunday, and it's simply a reminder for all of you that if you don't get to ask your question in this Paradoxes class, I do take questions on Facebook and Twitter. And yet literally every day, Reasons to Believe is posting video clips on our YouTube channel. You can subscribe to that channel for free. And, you know, we're going through a fairly lengthy course on dual revelation. And this is a book I wrote on our testable creation model a decade ago, More Than a Theory. And you can get a free chapter of that book at reasons.org/Ross. We also produce this docudrama on God's two books, the Book of Nature and the Book of Scripture. And you can get that by going to reasons.org/Ross. And every Sunday, we follow up our webinar, our Paradoxes webinar, with a Paradoxes meeting. And in the meeting, everybody will be able to turn on their cameras and their microphones. We'll be able to engage one another. It's a time for fellowship. And it's also a time where we can do some role plays. And what we've been doing the past couple of weeks is having people take turns to talk about their most recent meaningful spiritual conversation. You know, take a couple of minutes to share with us that. This is the URL you're going to need to get into the Zoom meeting. It's the same URL we've been using for the past weeks. And the URL is also posted at paradoxes.org. So if you go there, you will find that. So we're done with a second Q&A time. I'll stop the webinar and we can move into a Zoom meeting. And it was a few weeks ago, I talked about a recent scientific discovery where they found a really big water reservoir, one they never found noticed before. And it's called the Deep Water Reservoir. The fact that there's a huge amount of water in the continents of Earth that are below 2 kilometers from the surface. Basically, it's a water reservoir of between 2 and 10 kilometers depth on the continents. And I discussed several weeks ago how the discovery of that water reservoir actually helps us to understand how the plate tectonics operates in the way that is safe for life, but also plays a role in making sure there's adequate convection in the mantle of the Earth to sustain the magnetic field, which is crucial. Without a magnetosphere, we'd be killed immediately by cosmic rays and solar radiation. But we got into a brief discussion there about earthquakes, and I was making the point that this deep water cycle plays a role in making sure we get the adequate number and intensity of earthquakes, but not too many, not too few. And a lot of people have been asking me, Hugh, could you please develop a talk on earthquakes? And it's because so many unbelievers look at earthquakes as evidence for the non-existence of God. So here we see a relatively recent earthquake. This is the Nepal earthquake. And the question that's always been asked of Christians is, hey, the God of the Bible is an all-powerful, all-loving God. Could not an all-powerful, all-loving God create and design the earth in such a way so we wouldn't have these devastating earthquakes where our buildings get destroyed, people get killed and injured, and a lot of damage takes place? Well, I made a comment in the book, More Than a Theory, that what we actually see in the context of the laws of physics that God chose to govern the universe, that the quantity and the intensity of earthquakes is fine-tuned to make human civilization as optimal as possible. And a lot of people have been saying, Hugh, could you please expand on that? I intend to do that in a future book, but I'm also working on a talk. So what I'm going to share with you is the beginnings of a talk that I'm developing that answers this question. Could not an all-powerful, all-loving God create and design the earth so it would not have devastating earthquakes? And there's been papers published literally in just the past few weeks that give us fresh insight on earthquakes and the fine tuning of these earthquakes. Well, as a lot of you know, I do live in Southern California, and California is famous for its faults. And probably the most famous of our faults is the San Andreas Fault. It's actually in the process of splitting our state of California into two, where part of California is going to become an island in the Pacific and the other part will remain as part of North America. And so here's an aerial photo of the San Andreas Fault. And this is taken literally just 50 miles north of Los Angeles. And of all the states in the 50 states of America, California's got by far the greatest number of faults. It's got more faults than any other state in the union. And hey, that's a straight line for all of you comedians out there. So take it away and make whatever joke you want to make out of California having the greatest number of faults. But here's another aerial photo a little farther north showing the San Andreas Fault. And one of the places my wife and I visited a number of years ago is a national park called Pinnacles National Park. I think it's the latest national park that's been founded here in the state of California. It's a park a little bit south of the San Francisco Bay Area. And this is what the park looks like. And, you know, a few million years ago, this park was right on the San Andreas Fault. Since that time, the San Andreas Fault has moved a little bit east. But what's fascinating, why this is a national park, it's a mountain range that cut into two pieces by the San Andreas Fault, where half of the mountain range has moved north and the other half has moved south. And there's actually a trail that takes you along the top of this set of pinnacles. And having been there, it's literally a knife edge on one side, a knife edge that's been cut by the San Andreas Fault. And so this actually shows you part of the trail where they actually have to chop steps into the rock. And there's a handrail for you to hang on to, because to the right, it's a sheer drop of many hundreds of feet. This actually is a slice of this mountain range. So think of a mountain range being cut in two at the top by the San Andreas Fault. And so, yeah, you can, it's quite an interesting height to go along the top of this knife edge that's been cut by the San Andreas Fault. Here's another photo showing the crest of the pinnacles. And on the other side, you've got a sheer drop off. Now, that's half of the pinnacles. The other half of the pinnacles is 195 miles to the south. So about 30 to 50 miles north of Los Angeles, you got the other half of the pinnacles. And so the San Andreas Fault, you got part of California moving north. That's the part that San Francisco's on, and the rest of the state is moving south. So you got this tectonic movement going on, and it's quite a rapid movement. But this shot here shows you the Nenak Rocks. It's the other half of the pinnacles, just 30 miles north of Pasadena. You can visit this place, quite a rugged area, but this is literally the other half of the Pinnacles mountain range. So it gives you an idea about what these tectonic faults can do. And what's amazing is this movement is happening on a daily basis, but we really don't notice it. However, back in 1994, there was the Northridge earthquake. Northridge is one of the suburbs of Los Angeles. And it was a magnitude 6.7 earthquake. But, you know, living in the Los Angeles basin, they've got building codes that takes into account the certainty that earthquakes will happen. But freeways tend to be a little more subject to earthquake damage than buildings that are made of the appropriate materials. What's interesting about this photo is if you look at the buildings on either side of the freeway, they're intact. They're intact because of the strong building codes. You know, one of the reasons why homes are more expensive in California, you have to have a lot more lumber in them. So for example, you can't have a span that's more than 13 feet. And if you do, you have to build the home with 2x10s or 2x12s. So a lot more lumber, a lot more steel goes into the construction of our homes and buildings simply because we realize we live in earthquake territory. What's interesting about the Northridge earthquake, and you know, people look at the magnitude of the earthquake to determine how devastating it's going to be. A more important figure to look at in terms of damage is what they call the ground acceleration. And this Northridge earthquake holds the world record for the greatest amount of ground acceleration in an urban area. It was 1.82 Gs of ground acceleration. And the incredible thing is, in spite of this really large ground acceleration, the death toll from this earthquake was only 60. And a lot of those 60 were people having heart attacks while they were being shaken up. It wasn't really dying from so much the damage, but just by being shaken. And in spite of having 1.82 Gs of ground acceleration, this photo here shows you the Northquake's most severely damaged building. So this is, it's an apartment complex. This is the building that's the greatest amount of damage in the Northridge earthquake. But if you look at this, you see, yes, there's a lot of damage, but if you're inside this apartment complex, it's definitely survivable. You know, the thing didn't collapse upon you. Basically, the main part of the structure stayed intact. So it explains why the death toll was as low as it was. In spite of all that ground shaking, the buildings basically withstood. And what I want to do is compare this with the 2010 Haiti earthquake. The 2010 Haiti earthquake did this kind of damage. I mean, here you see in Port-au-Prince, the main city in Haiti, virtually total damage. Every structure collapsed. And so you look around and just horrific damage everywhere. And with the collapse of all these structures, people were being injured, they were being killed. And you say, well, wasn't this a bigger magnitude earthquake? Yes, it was. Instead of a 6.7, it was a 7.0 magnitude. However, as I mentioned before, the real measure is ground acceleration. And the ground acceleration here was 0.65 Gs. So three times less than the Northridge earthquake. But look at all the damage. And the reason why is the building codes here in Haiti really do not take into account the probability that they're going to get earthquakes. And you're probably aware, Haiti has received a number of earthquakes. So with only one third the ground acceleration, the death toll here was a minimum of 160,000. So compare that with 160,000. And, you know, there's a passage in the Bible, in the book of Matthew, chapter 7, 24, a wise man built his house on the rock. And Jesus was talking in a parable about, you know, hey, we know we live in a world where things happen. As Jesus said, in this world, you'll have tribulation, but take heart, I've overcome the world. As long as we're in the physical universe, thermodynamics will operate, things will happen. But Jesus basically exhorts us to prepare. Hey, if you live on the beach, east-facing beach in Florida, you better prepare for hurricanes, because hurricanes are going to happen. And you need to build your home appropriately. And likewise, here in California, we know earthquakes will happen, and so we build our homes accordingly. I mention this because earthquake, California is not the state that's at greatest risk of earthquake damage. In fact, it's quite a bit down the list. There are many other states in the U.S. that are much higher risk of earthquake damage and deaths and injuries. The wonderful thing about California is we have lots of faults. And because of all the earthquake faults, earthquake energy doesn't travel that far. It stops when it runs into another fault. So for example, I remember a few years ago, there was a massive earthquake about 150 miles north of us, about 200 miles north of us, 7.4 earthquake. And where we lived, you couldn't feel the earthquake at all. And all the faults in between basically dissipated the energy. That's not the case for most of the rest of the country. And there's three major faults. Here in California, about the worst earthquake you can get is a magnitude 8 earthquake, but other parts of the US, you can get magnitude 9s. And keep in mind, with every magnitude you go up, you get a factor of 10 greater energy intensity. And to give you some context, a magnitude 9 earthquake is sufficiently violent that it can shake the bark off trees. So all the bark falls off the trees because of the shaking. And this next map here actually shows you where earthquakes greater than 6.0 have occurred between 1900 and 2017. The black ones are magnitude 9s. And then you can see the legend over there for 8s, 7s, and 6s. And the thing about California, it's interesting. We literally get 100 earthquakes every day between magnitude 1 and magnitude 2. But at that magnitude range, you will not feel it unless you're right on top of the earthquake, and the earthquake is very close to the surface. So these happen all the time and nobody notices. But we get 6 earthquakes a day on average, better between 1 and 2. And yeah, if you're really close, you will feel those. But we only get 6 per year that are greater than magnitude 5. And in terms of those that are greater than magnitude 6, that's about 6 per decade. And this is interesting because evidently the tectonic activity of planet Earth is designed. This is typical of the rest of the world, where you get exponentially greater earthquakes at a lower magnitude. And this is actually a design feature of our planet, that we get way more small earthquakes than we do big earthquakes. And it's crucial for advanced life to be sustained on planet Earth that the tectonic plates move. But you really want to design in such a way that most of the movement takes place through small earthquakes rather than big earthquakes. And that is, in fact, what we see. But in terms of the rest of the United States, for example, right off the coast of Portland and Seattle and Tacoma, you got the Juan de Fuca Fault. It's just off the coast, and it doesn't rupture very often, only about once every 1,000 years. But when it does rupture, you get a magnitude 9 earthquake. And you say, when's the last time it ruptured? Well, a little more than 1,000 years ago. So it's overdue for a rupture. But what's interesting, if you go to Oregon and the state of Washington and up into British Columbia, they do not have earthquake codes in their building codes. And so you've got a lot of brick buildings, for example, in Seattle. And unreinforced brick buildings will collapse with a magnitude 5.5 earthquake. And so with a magnitude 9, all those buildings are coming down. There's a reason why you only see decorative brick in California. We're not allowed to make buildings out of brick that have that are for structure, only for decoration, with a recognition an earthquake's going to cause them all to fall off. But another place that's a great risk is the Mississippi Valley, the Madrid Fault. It ruptures about every 150 years, and it's just south of Memphis, where the last big earthquake took place, and that happened about 170 years ago. But when it did rupture, because of the lack of faults in the eastern U.S., it rang church bells over the entire eastern U.S. Even the church bells in Boston were ringing as a result of the rupture of that fault. Now, back in the 1850s, when it ruptured, hardly anybody lived in the area, and those people that did live in the area were living in wooden one-story homes, which are able to withstand earthquake quite well. And so there was minimal damage and death as a result. That's no longer the case today. But because earthquakes happen so seldomly in those regions, the building codes aren't in place. But once again, back to Matthew chapter 7. I mean, you realize we do live in a world where disasters happen. So if you live in Texas, or Oklahoma, it's important to be prepared for tornadoes. You know they're going to happen. And so people there have tornado shelters. And tornadoes happen often enough, everybody is prepared for the onset of a tornado. And likewise, there are people that are prepared for hurricane damage in certain parts of the U.S. Southeast, because we know these things are going to happen. They're not so well prepared for earthquakes. Earthquakes will happen in those regions as well. But as you can see in this map, most of the earthquakes, the really big earthquakes, happen along the Pacific Rim and along the Himalayas and the mountain ranges that go through Iran and Greece and Italy. So this is the tectonically active regions. And you've got a lot of tectonics going on in the mountain range in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. But hey, that's far enough away from where people live that you know it doesn't really cause any damage. So, but I want to get into how these water reservoirs are designed in such a way to ensure that we get adequate tectonic plate movement and why we need that tectonic plate movement, but in such a way where we have very little damage because most of the earthquakes are at a very tiny level where we don't even notice them. As I said, in California, we get more than 100 per day, but they're the 100 that nobody notices because of how gentle they are. And we rarely get the ones that are big enough where we notice. I did have the experience once of experiencing a magnitude 6 earthquake where we were right on top of the epicenter. We were literally less than a mile away from the epicenter, and it was fairly shallow, so it really shook our... That time, we were living in a townhouse, and it shook at about 6 a.m. in the morning, and was so violent that we had a chest of drawers in our bedroom, and all the drawers went flying out of the chest and went across the room, hit the wall, and when they hit the wall, they shattered. But after the earthquake was over, I inspected our townhouse for damage. A lot of furniture was damaged, but there was zero damage to the structure of our townhouse, not even a crack that needed to be patched or any chip paint. Everything was solid. So it shows you these building codes really do work quite well. However, we did have to replace that chest of drawers. And I'm fortunate that none of us was around to be hit by that flying, those flying drawers coming out. Okay, let's look at these known terrestrial water sources. This is a review from we covered several weeks ago. We announced a discovery, first time discovery of what's called the deep terrestrial water reservoir. But this is a map that I showed back then, basically showing you the most familiar water reservoir, which is lakes and rivers. And yeah, if you go to Northern Ontario, virtually the entire part of that region is nothing but lakes and rivers. Everywhere you go, there's lakes and rivers. You don't have to walk very far before you run into a lake or river. Canada actually has more than half of the world's lakes. And so that's a major source of terrestrial water, lakes and rivers. But another source would be glaciers and ice fields. And yeah, if you live in at high latitudes, you see evidence of that. There's just as much water. There's actually more water in glaciers and ice fields, even at relatively low latitudes, than there are in lakes and rivers. A third major reservoir is the troposphere. There's a lot of water in the atmosphere above us in terms of clouds, just the humidity. In fact, there's now a new technology where they found a way to pull water out of the atmosphere and use it to feed the water delivery systems for farms and for cities and towns. And it's actually relatively inexpensive. This could be a major factor in the dealing with the droughts that plague many parts of the world. And what they've noticed is even over desert regions, there is a lot of water in the atmosphere and water that can be tapped to help us with our agricultural needs, with the ecosystems, and with our cities and towns. And number four is what's called the shallow ground reservoir. This is the upper 2 kilometers, so it's groundwater. But the brand new discovery announced several weeks ago was they discovered there's a deep groundwater reservoir. And the discovery of this deep ground reservoir basically solved a major problem. And what we observe is that there's relatively efficient plate tectonic activity going on. And there's three types. You got the one like the San Andreas Fault, where you got two plates that slip past one another. But more common is what we call subduction. And this takes place in the oceans, where you got an oceanic plate coming into contact with a continental plate, and where one plate slips underneath the other. And there's cases where you got two terrestrial plates meeting one another, such as what you have in the Himalayas. And there again, you got one plate going over the other. So one plate can go over the other, plates can go underneath one another, and they can slip past one another. But all that requires water in order for these plates to be able to efficiently move with respect to one another without generating really major earthquakes, like magnitudes 10s, 11s, 12s, 13s, up to 15s. That's what would happen if we didn't have all these water sources. And if you read the old textbooks on plate tectonics, they basically give all the attention to the water in the ocean. But we now know that there's not sufficient water in the oceans at a sufficient temperature and chemistry to provide the plate tectonic activity that's necessary to sustain advanced life without generating really major earthquakes. In other words, it takes all five terrestrial water reservoirs plus all the water in the oceans to sustain plate tectonics at the minimum level needed to recycle nutrients and ensure the continental land area remains at the optimal 29% of Earth's surface. And if you actually look at the plate tectonic history of the Earth, we've gone from having no continents at all to the present 29%. And plate tectonic activity has been increasing that. 2.5 billion years ago, it jumped from 2% up to 27%. And since that time, it's been gradually increasing from 27 to 29. But 29% is what's optimal for global human civilization. We're eventually going to get to 30%. And when we get to 30%, then we're no longer going to be able to sustain global human civilization. A number of catastrophes are going to take place. Peter Ward, a paleontologist, has written books on this, basically warning us what's going to happen when it hits 30%. But he also explains how bad things are when it's 28%. Not bad for a primitive life, not bad for plants and animals, but bad for the kinds of plants and animals we need to sustain global human civilization. 29% is optimal. And isn't it interesting that God created human beings at that very moment when the continental landmass coverage hit 29%? But the problem is the continents are being eroded away by wind and water erosion. And again, I live sufficiently close to the coast of California. I can actually witness year by year, California getting smaller and smaller as a result of erosion. But actually, California is getting larger, not smaller. Reason why is because of plate tectonics. The plate tectonics is sufficiently active here in the state of California that in spite of the rather aggressive erosion of our coastal areas by the waves crashing in along the shore, there's a reason why surfing is good here. We get big waves, but those big waves are constantly eroding away our coasts. But thanks to plate tectonics, our state is actually being elevated. And so the state is actually growing faster. You say, well, which state in the union is growing the fastest? That would be Hawaii. Hawaii is the fastest growing state because you've got not only the tectonics, you've got the volcanic activity that's causing particularly the island of Hawaii to get larger every year. So we need the plate tectonic activity to be sufficient that we don't have the continents getting smaller. We want to remain at that optimal 29% for as long as human civilization is here, but a more important reason that tectonics recycle nutrients. And so it's important that life essential nutrients get recycled from the mantle up into the crust and from the oceans to the continents and the continents back to the oceans. And so you need fairly aggressive, sustained plate tectonic activity to ensure that the nutrients are recycled at a level that's going to sustain global civilization. And it's not just nutrients, certain gases must be recycled. And so I've written articles that you'll find at reasons.org under my Today's New Reason to Believe, where I talk about how plate tectonics recycles carbon dioxide, oxygen, and water at a rate that is able to sustain global high technology civilization. So that's the reason why we need the plate tectonics to be at the level they are. And we notice is it's at the minimum level needed to sustain global human civilization. We could have these nutrients recycled with greater plate tectonic activity, but we needed to be at the minimum level. It's at that minimum level. And I'm grateful for that, because if it was beyond the minimum level, we'd have all the nutrients we would need. We'd be able to sustain the growth of the continents, be able to sustain the recycling of water and carbon dioxide and oxygen. However, we'd have more earthquake activity. We'd have more volcanic activity, and that would cause more harm to human beings. So we see it's at just that minimum level to make sure that things don't become worse. But also we notice that it takes all five of these terrestrial water reservoirs, plus the water in the ocean, to ensure sufficient mantle convection to sustain Earth's magnetic field magnetosphere. So it's not just the recycling of nutrients. It's not just the recycling of water, carbon dioxide, and the oxygen. And it's not just the need to make sure that we keep the continental landmass coverage at 29%. Having these water reservoirs and the water in the ocean, thanks to plate tectonics, having that being pulled into the mantle, what this does, it sustains the mantle convection. Now, mantle convection is not the only requirement, but is one requirement that's necessary to sustain Earth's magnetic field at the level that it does. And it's because of that magnetic field, we have a magnetosphere, a magnetic shield that surrounds the Earth that protects us from deadly solar and cosmic radiation. So it's our magnetosphere that protects us from deadly cosmic and solar radiation and prevents the sun from sputtering away our atmosphere and our hydrosphere. And the other amazing thing about the water is that the water itself provides a lubricant that allows these plates to slide against one another or under or over one another. But the other thing geochemists have discovered, that the water acts as a lubricant in two ways. The water actually allows these tectonic plates to move relative to one another, but where you have two plates in contact with one another and where there is movement, the liquid water chemically reacts with the material in the tectonic plates, the oceanic and the continental plate. And what it does is that chemical reaction produces talc. And so you get the water hydrating the minerals in Earth's crust at asthenosphere and upper mantle, produces talc, and this talc further lubricates the tectonic plate movements. And the bottom line is that you get these plates moving with small earthquakes far more frequently than with major earthquakes. And again, just because of the way the Earth is structured, you will find places where you don't have the amount of lubrication there. Talc or the water, and there you get the plate stuck and things build up, and then you get a major rupture. That's the problem with the Madrid Fault in the Mississippi Valley, is it doesn't have the quantity of lubrication that is typical of the faults here in California, and therefore the energy builds up and you get a major earthquake. But typically we see around the planet is that thanks to the five different sources of terrestrial liquid water and all the oceanic water, and the fact that water itself is a lubricant and the talc is a lubricant, we get minimal earthquakes. And so we get the optimal situation where we get the plates moving relative to one another, but predominantly the movement is through small earthquakes. And yeah, you actually see, literally 100 small earthquakes per day, and you only get, 6 per decade here in California of the ones that are greater than 6.0. And so there's this power law of earthquakes that actually works to minimize the damage and the trauma to human beings and their animals. So in the context of the laws of physics that God chose to govern the universe and the earth and the timing of our appearance on earth, we're experiencing the best possible earthquake activity. That's the answer to the skeptic. That given the laws of physics that God chose to govern the universe, you really couldn't have earthquake activity at a more optimal level. We're getting just the right amount of earthquake activity, not too much, not too level, just the right amount of tectonic movement. And that movement is facilitated by earthquakes that ensure that we have the minimum disruption to human activity, human civilization, and the minimum suffering from injury and deaths as a result of being exposed. Nevertheless, we should take the counsel of Jesus into account. Make sure you build your house on a rock and not on a sand. Make sure that you take into account, hey, these things will happen. You know, it's interesting that, I have earthquake insurance on our home here in California. It costs me about $1,200 a year for that insurance. And, most people in the U.S. don't have earthquake insurance. And what I find is it's actually cheaper in other states than it is here in California. But the risk is actually far greater outside of California. So those of you living outside of California, earthquake insurance is a real bargain. It's going to happen. And, the consequences could be quite devastating. But this also raises a question. Well, I mean, God is all powerful and all loving. Why doesn't he just give us different laws of physics? Couldn't God create a realm where there's no earthquakes at all? And the answer is yes. In fact, the answer is in the new creation, there will be no earthquakes. There will be no tornadoes. There will be no wildfires. There will be no hurricanes. People aren't going to die of disease or parasites or suffer from them. That's the new creation. The new creation will have different laws of physics, but this creation has gravity, electromagnetism, thermodynamics, the strong and weak nuclear force. Those forces are designed in such a way to enable us to thrive here on planet Earth within the vast universe, but they're also designed in such a way to be tools in God's hands for the rapid and efficient eradication of evil and suffering. And again, John 16:33, Jesus said to his disciples, "In this world you will have tribulation, but take heart, I have overcome the world." The tribulation now is absolutely essential for God to eradicate evil and suffering once and for all, while he enhances the free will capability of human beings to experience and express love. That was God's primary goal in creating the universe. As it says in Timothy and Titus, God began his works of redemption before he created anything at all. So God primarily designed the universe, the laws of physics, in such a way as to make possible the redemption of billions of human beings from their sin and evil, and for their free will capabilities to experience and express love to be exponentially enhanced. That's why we have thermodynamics. That's why we have electromagnetism and gravity. And that's why I wrote the book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. And I've been pleased to tell you, a lot of atheists have read that book and come to Christ as a result. And what they tell me is, it's those chapters on the laws of physics that really helped them understand why an all-powerful, all-loving God would make the universe the way he did, and why gravity and thermodynamics and electromagnetism and the earthquakes that come with it really are expressions of God's deep love for us human beings. So this is a talk I'm working on, and I'm going to be fine-tuning it. Appreciate any feedback that you might have, because a number of churches have been saying, we'd love for you to give a talk on the benefit and how God expresses his love through earthquakes. And, you know, I wrote this paper in a peer-reviewed journal on how black holes are an expression of God's care. And people have been saying, Hugh, we'd love you to follow this up with an article and a talk on how God expresses his care through earthquakes. So that's what I'm working on. But the bottom line is earthquakes indeed are evidence of God's surpassing love for humanity. Well, I can tell I'm actually over time. So I'm going to just stop right here. We'll pick up the lesson on dual revelation next week. And hopefully by next week, we'll be able to give you an announcement. Actually, be a couple of weeks from now, I'm going to have one of our scholar community people teach, because next Sunday, I'm actually going to be in Texas speaking at a major church in the Dallas area there. If you want details, it's up on our website. But yeah, I'm going to be in Texas. Actually, starting tomorrow, I'll be speaking at the Evangelical Philosophical Society Conference in Fort Worth, and then doing a number of events thereafter in the Dallas area. But 2 weeks from now, I'll be back. And hopefully by then, we can make an announcement of where we're going to launch the in-person meetings. So with that, let me stop the share feature, and we'll have a time for Q&A before we go into our web meeting.
All right. Thank you for that, Hugh. Questions. Joey says, Dr. Ross, he says, many times I've seen you explain very extensively the four different literal definitions of the word yom, translated day in Genesis 1. It is very clear that there's room in the limited vocabulary of the Hebrew language for 3 days to be long but definite periods of time. Do you have a similar breakdown for the words translated evening and morning? All I've found is an article where you say that people have multiple meanings, but the base meaning is ending and beginning. I haven't been able to find this from any other source.
Yes, you'll find that in writing in both the book Navigating Genesis and the other book I've written, A Matter of Days, the second edition. Both of those books, I give you the lexical definitions. And basically, I make the point that because Biblical Hebrew has such a small vocabulary, almost every single Hebrew noun has multiple distinct literal definitions, which is why it's so important to look at the context when you read the Old Testament to see which definition of the Hebrew word you want to go with. In case of the Hebrew words that are translated evening and a morning, each of them has three distinct literal definitions. And it can mean the evening and the morning. It can mean the evening and the morning of a 24-hour day. It can mean the evening and the morning of an era. It can also mean the beginning and the ending. So again, go to those two books. I'll give you word-for-word definitions. And a good place to go, you can go to any Hebrew English lexicon, but if you want a full discussion of the range of definitions and the context of different passages, the Theological Wordbook of the Old Testament is an excellent source. What I love about the Theological Wordbook of the Old Testament, it not only gives you the distinct different definitions for every Hebrew noun, but also takes you through the Old Testament and shows you how the word is used in different passages in the Old Testament. So typically you get a page or two of discussion about every Hebrew noun. So it's a little more than a lexicon. It actually takes you into the different texts. But yeah, I cite that Theological Word Book of the Old Testament in both Navigating Genesis and then A Matter of Days, second edition. But, you know, even before I was aware of these Hebrew English aids, I remember at age 17 reading Genesis 1 and recognizing that the word day I saw in my English translation must have had at least three distinct definitions in the original Hebrew, because obviously you see three different usages of the word literally on the first page of the Bible. When you get into creation day one, it's using the word day to describe the daylight hours. On creation day four, it's using the word day to describe a 24-hour rotation period. And in Genesis 2:4, it uses the word day to describe the entirety of creation history. So that's the daylight hours, a 24-hour period, and a long finite period of time. There's actually a fourth definition, which is part of the daylight hours. So my point is, even without the lexicons, you can tell that the word yom must have distinct literal definitions. And at age 17, the reason I concluded that these days had to be consecutive long periods of time, there is no evening morning phrase for the seventh day. There is for the first 6 days. And whatever definition you choose for the Hebrew words for evening and morning, they all mean that each of these creation days has a definite start time and a definite end time. The lack of the evening morning phrase for the seventh day tells us that the day is not yet ended. And indeed, you see that affirmed both in Psalm 95 and Hebrews 4, which tell us we're still in God's seventh day. And I think I've told the story before. At age 17, recognizing that we're still in God's seventh day answered for me the fossil record enigma. Why we see in the fossil record previous to human beings all this evidence for new phyla and new classes and new orders suddenly appearing, and we don't see any such evidence in the human era. For 6 days, God creates. On the seventh day, he stops creating.
Awesome. Thank you. I skipped one. It's a relevant question here. Von Mancha asked regarding the string theory questions before. He says, isn't string theory being more and more ignored? And then he references Sabine Hossenfelder.
Yes. While Sabine and other theoretical physicists are reminding us that string theory is just one of multiple theories that theoretical physicists have developed to explain the array of fundamental particles we see and how they come into existence. It's still an excellent candidate to explain how these particles come to be. But a lot of lay people think it's the only game in town, and that's not true. Theoretical physicists have other models to explain them, but what they all share in common, they all appeal to extra dimensions of space. What particle physicists recognize, if you have a universe with one time dimension and three space dimensions, that doesn't allow enough spatial room for all the symmetries that are required for both particle physics, gravity, and general relativity. And therefore, we need more dimensions to create the spatial room so that we can have all those symmetries. And a requirement for life, life requires the operation of gravity, general relativity, and quantum mechanics. And you can't have those three coexisting if all you got is three large dimensions of space. We do need extra dimensions of space. And we do need a model where those extra dimensions of space stop expanding when gravity separates out. So that's what they all have in common. And string theory is simply the most popular of the theoretical explanations for how we come up with the particles that we come up with.
Is there a quick way to describe symmetries? And also I would ask, what are some of those competing theories other than string theory?
Well, you got something called M theory. But again, what's interesting about M theory, it speculates that not only is there extra tiny dimensions, it speculates that there's an extra large dimension. So they have four large dimensions of space. Some even talk about a fifth large dimension of space. So there is speculation, but the minimal model out there, the string theory model, says one dimension of time, three large dimensions of space, and six tiny dimensions of space. But there are other models. Now, there was a time when they were speculating, could we go with more tiny dimensions of space? And there's a group that I was familiar with at Caltech that included one of our visiting or scholar community people. And they had the problem of saying, okay, it looks like the models could go anywhere from, 5 extra dimensions of space all the way up to, 28 dimensions of space, and eventually settled on the 6. So there are some restrictions at that level. Now, as far as these symmetries are concerned, probably the best way to understand them is to, in the context of unified field theory. Unified field theory basically tells us when the universe is very young, it's extremely hot. Universe starts off near infinitely compressed and near infinitely hot. God created it with a property of expansion. And with expansion, the space dimensions begin to unfurl. And so there's a loss of space curvature and the temperature goes down. But at very high temperatures, all the forces of physics are united into a single force. If you want an analogy, think what happens to a bar magnet when you heat it up. If you heat it up above 500 degrees, the magnetism disappears. It appears to disappear. What happens is the heat energy and the magnetic energy blend together to form one energy source. However, as you cool it down, you can recover the distinction between the heat energy and the magnetic energy. In the same way, if you make the energy density greater, what you can observe, and this has been done in particle physics experiments, where you can actually observe the electromagnetic force coalescing with the weak nuclear force and forming a single force that theoretical physicists have called the electroweak force. This is what's entirely observed in particle accelerators, where they basically duplicated the energy density conditions that existed in the first split second of the history of the universe. And they're able to see the force of the weak nuclear force and the electromagnetic force blending together to become a single electroweak force. That was done in the early 1970s. And you probably heard of the Large Hadron Collider, the CERN in Switzerland and France. And that's giving us some insight on the next step of unification, where the electroweak force unifies with a strong nuclear force. That particle accelerator is only 17 miles long, and that's not nearly long enough to see the entirety of the unification. It's getting us part way, which is telling us it looks like unified field theory is correct. But to go all the way, you would need a particle accelerator 40 trillion miles long. And it'll be a while before the taxpayers decide to fund such a long particle accelerator. So that's kind of where we stand right now. But what is interesting is that every time a force of physics separates out, you get symmetry breaking. And you get a different kind of symmetry breaking at each point. Now, I think I'm going to stop there, because if you push me, it gets really technical from that point onward. But there's some excellent books written on it, and I've written some lay-level articles that you'll see at reasons.org about that. And there's a little bit on it in the Creator and the Cosmos 4th edition.
Awesome. And I would say that your apologetic class on, Design and Universe? I forget the name of it, but it's a really good course on that. It touches.
Yeah, the course we have on astronomy, it's part of Reasons Institute, gets into that. And the main point is the symmetry breaking must be exquisitely fine-tuned in order for light to be possible later in the universe. So, for example, you get a symmetry breaking at about 10 to the minus 35 seconds, where you get the annihilation of particles and antiparticles. But it must be extraordinarily fine-tuned to ensure you get just the right excess of particles compared to antiparticles. So that's just one example of the symmetry breaking fine tuning. But yeah, for all this to work, you do need extra dimensions of space.
Okay, thank you. Mark Durham asks, is it feasible to make an artificial magnetosphere to surround a human inhabited spaceship or colony and thus avoid deadly radiation?
Hi, yes. And hey, if you watch Star Trek, that's what's going on with Star Trek. They got this little shield around their Enterprise spacecraft. And but what we're now realizing is that it's extremely difficult to have a stable artificial magnetosphere around something like a typical spaceship. And what we now know is that in order to have the necessary stability of that magnetic shield, you need a lot of gravity to stabilize it, which means your spaceship has got to be very massive. You say, how massive? Well, it needs to be at least as big as the Death Star that you see in the Star Wars movie series. In other words, you need something of a minimum size of about our moon. So if you're willing to build a spaceship the size of our moon, you can have it designed in such a way it'll have a stable magnetosphere around it. But to take something like the Starship Enterprise and try to build a magnetosphere around it, we now know enough about the physics to realize that's not going to work. And so your alternative would be to actually have some kind of shield to protect you from the radiation. You say, well, how much shielding would you need? Well, a foot thickness of lead would be adequate, but now that makes for a very heavy spaceship. And lead, by the way, is plastic, so it moves, it's very soft. And moreover, keep in mind that lead is the byproduct of uranium and thorium decay. And so wherever you got a lot of lead, you're gonna have some residual uranium and thorium. And the radiation from that is not safe. And so we do have a problem of trying to get people to, say, Mars. Getting people to Mars without them dying on the way is going to be a big challenge. And people typically have been thinking, well, we do know we have to give them artificial gravity. And by the way, that's another reason why you want a big spaceship. If you want artificial gravity, I mean, your typical thing is you've got a human habitat capsule and you've got a long rod with a counterweight on it. And you have the thing rotating in such a way that people are pushed against the edge of the habitat capsule. But unless it's really, really big, you're going to have a different gravitational feel on your feet than you do on your head. And so you want the spaceship to be big enough that the gravity you feel at your head is not going to be too much less than the gravity you feel at your feet. And now, again, you're looking at something really expensive. You say, well, they don't worry about gravity in the International Space Station. They don't, because the International Space Station, you're protected by Earth's magnetosphere. And what they do is they have people exercise 4 hours a day on a treadmill. And you basically attach bungee cords to yourself, and which tries to simulate gravity. Then you run on this treadmill. But even then, even if you do 4 hours of treadmill running a day, and by the way, I've talked to people who've been on the International Space Station, and they tell me it's extraordinarily challenging to discipline yourself to run on a treadmill with bungee cords attached to you for 4 hours a day. You know, it's one thing to go to a gym for half an hour and get a workout. It's quite another matter to do a sustained workout for 4 solid hours. And says it's not comfortable running with bungee cords attached to you. It's just not the same as going to the gym. And even then, you will suffer 1% bone loss per month. And so if you spend 6 months on the space station, you will lose 6% of your bone mass. And it's permanent. It doesn't come back. And therefore, if you're going to send people to Mars, you got to send them with artificial gravity. And then you got to find some way to protect them from the deadly radiation from the sun and from cosmic rays that they're going to experience out there. And bottom line is you're looking at a really expensive, big and heavy spaceship in order to give them adequate preparation. One model I saw decades ago is they said, we need a cylinder about 10 kilometers long and about 2 kilometers in diameter where it's rotating to give the appropriate gravity, where the gravity at your head will not be sufficiently different from the gravity on your feet. And then you need to embed into that cylinder radiation protection. But now you're looking at something really heavy and really expensive. But bottom line, it's still cheaper than colonizing Mars. There was a proposal made as far back as the 1950s. We could build this artificial planet. And the cost of building the planet in such a way that human beings would be safe on that is actually cheaper than trying to colonize Mars or trying to colonize the moon or any other body in the solar system. But bottom line is it's not in the budget of any nation to be able to build such a massive spaceship. No, even if all the nations of the world cooperated, it still couldn't be funded, at least not at the level of funding available we have today.
Okay, thank you. Ronald Hawking, he asks, do black holes die?
Black holes do die, but it takes a long time for them to die. And how they die is they become white holes. And Stephen Hawking got worldwide fame through publishing a paper on this a few decades ago, basically making the point, a black hole is a massive body that has collapsed to such a degree that it's not able to withstand the force of gravity. The force of gravity will continue collapsing the black hole. So the black hole basically gets smaller and smaller and smaller as it gets older and older. And eventually the black hole collapses to a point where it reaches the dimension of a quantum entity. In other words, where it gets to the size of, say, a proton. And when that happens, quantum mechanics actually will deliver a stronger force than gravity will. And so all the stuff that's been sucked into the black hole will actually radiate out as a result of quantum radiation. And so it's basically quantum tunneling. And it was Stephen Hawking that calculated how long it takes for a black hole to become a white hole. And basically says the bigger the black hole, the longer it takes to become a white hole. The smallest black hole we can conceive of is a little more than 3 times the mass of our star, the sun. And a black hole of that minimal mass, Stephen calculated that it would take 10 to the 66 years for it to collapse sufficiently, where all the stuff trapped inside of it will quantum tunnel out and it becomes a flashing giant white hole. And since the universe is only 10 to the 10 years old, the universe is way too young for any black holes to have died and become white holes. So we're a long ways from being able to see that.
Okay, Susan Lambau asks, did you hear about a possible finding of Planet X in old data? I'm not sure the whole
yes.
thing.
Yeah, there is a search for a ninth planet. And it's been going on now for about a decade. And the original clue that such a planet might exist is that we now have telescopes powerful enough, we can map the orbits of distant comets, comets in the Oort belt in particular. And what we see is out in the near part of the Oort belt is there's a knot of overlapping big comet orbits. And a number of astronomers have determined that knot could be explained by the existence of a ninth planet. A ninth planet that would come in at about 10 times the mass of the Earth and be 50 times more distant from the sun than Neptune is. So Neptune's about 3.5 billion miles away from the sun. We're looking at something that's like 160 billion miles away from the sun. So really distant. And at that distance, such an object will be extremely difficult to detect. A number of astronomers say we may not be able, with existing telescope power, to be able to detect such an object. although the extremely large telescope as being constructed by the European Southern Observatory in Chile. It's going to have a mirror 100 feet in diameter. That should be powerful enough to make such a detection. However, a number of other astronomers have said, we don't need that planet to explain that knot. There's other explanations. One thing we do know for sure, however, is that the solar system began with 10 planets. Five rocky planets, where one of those rocky planets merged with the Earth, and that led to the moon forming event, but there are actually five gas giant planets. So it was Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and a fifth planet. And that fifth planet got ejected. And there's two models that are able to explain the structure of the solar system. And the big problem is how to explain why Mars is as small as it is, given its distance from the sun. Without a fifth gas giant planet, you'd have Mars being more massive than the Earth. And that would cause problems for advanced life here on planet Earth. So we need a small Mars. And the way you get a small Mars is through a fifth gas giant planet, where the gravitational interaction between Jupiter and Saturn ejects the planet totally out of the solar system. That's one scenario. A second scenario is it strongly ejects it into the extreme outer part of the solar system. And so if that model is correct, we have the possibility of detecting a ninth planet, but it's going to be extraordinarily challenging because of how distant that planet will be and how small it is. It's only 10 times more massive than the Earth and would be 50 times more distant than Neptune is from the sun. So it's an ongoing quest. Papers get published about once a month, giving us an update on the quest to find that planet. But the consensus I'm seeing in the published literature is astronomers are more and more coming around to the fact that they don't think a ninth planet exists. The ninth planet got completely ejected. But hey, the jury's not out yet. Let's wait and see.
Great. That's the last scientific question we have for today. Oh, wait, maybe. Oh, no, a couple more.
Hey, let's just take one more because we're coming up against our time.
Well, one is like Doug is asking if you have anything on Amazon.Echo. How does he find you there? Because he's found Ken Samples, but he can't find you. I think that's what the gist of his question.
That's the first time I've heard of Amazon.Echo. I don't know about it. If people can pass that on to our team here at Reasons to Believe, we'll check it out. Might be something that's worth investigating. But I guess I'm not on Amazon.Echo because I've never even heard of Amazon.Echo. So Doug, if you can pass that information on to our marketing team, I think they would really appreciate it. And maybe they can show me how to get some exposure there.
Okay. So Jonathan Sparks, our last question is 11:58. So Jonathan Sparks asked, do you expect AI to provide solutions to big problems anytime soon?
Well, I think the best hope I see for artificial intelligence would be to actually have self-driving vehicles. In other words, if we could develop the artificial intelligence where the computer drives a car for you. You just simply plug in where you want to go and it gets you there. And the wonderful thing is there'd be no traffic accidents. There'd be no traffic deaths. And we'd be able to get to where we want to go a lot faster. And you'd be able to have five lanes for the same width of a freeway. That is four lanes today. So you'd be able to move a lot more traffic. And, the one profession that employs the greatest number of workers here in the U.S. is truck drivers. So if we had self-driving trucks, we could literally set free millions of workers here in the U.S. To do more meaningful work. And so that could be a huge boost to the world economy. I mean, right now we're facing a labor shortage. Wouldn't it be great if we could just have all those truck drivers work in other professions? I think they'd be more fulfilled because they'd have more meaningful work. and be a great boost to the economy. What's stopping that development? Number one, we don't quite yet have the GPS positioning. They're actually setting up a GPS system of satellites. They'll be able to pinpoint the position of your computer, your device, or anything you're wearing on your being to within 1 centimeter. So they'll know what lane you're in, not just what highway you're on, but what lane you're in and where you are in the lane. We're going to need that kind of technology to have a safe self-driving vehicle system. The other thing is the software needs to be upgraded. Right now, I've been reading an article on this, and it said they do have self-driving cars. The problem is the system is not able to distinguish between an empty paper bag on the freeway and an obstacle that could actually do damage to the vehicle. Likewise, the AI system is not able to appropriately distinguish between a street sign that's meant for traffic control and, say, some placard a protester is putting up, or an advertising sign that somebody's putting up, or a prank. Basically, they're saying, you know, once you have the system up and running, you have to take into account there will be nefarious individuals who will try to put up fake signs, traffic signs, to throw off the self-driving system. So the artificial intelligence needs to be intelligent enough to be able to distinguish between a fake sign and a real sign, between an empty paper bag on the freeway and piece of debris that could cause some damage. So we're a ways off yet from having self-driving vehicles. But if we were to have that, it'd be a huge boost to the economy. So that's the thing I'm looking forward to the most. But there also is, of course, and my colleague, Jeff Swearing, has written a book on artificial intelligence where he goes into some other applications, particularly health applications. There's a potential to use artificial intelligence to take bioengineered viruses, for example, and be able to deliver cures for genetic diseases and even cures for things like COVID. We could tackle it with these things with very high efficiency. Are we there yet? We're nowhere close. But you know, things like that are potentially capable of happening. So artificial intelligence is a lot of capability. We can use it more than just playing chess. So there's some real applications. The concern that Jeff deals with in the book, however, we have to be careful about some political system, leader, or dictator taking advantage of artificial intelligence to control human beings. So for example, they could put a chip, and we already have that. I mean, people put chips in their dogs and cats. So if they lose their dog or cat, they can immediately find exactly where their dog or cat is. And I know a lot of parents that are tempted to put chips into their teenagers so they can figure out where they are and keep them out of trouble. It's illegal to do that, but we can easily imagine sometime in the future, some dictator insisting that everybody have a chip implanted in them so that dictator could control the behavior and the activities of those individuals. So yeah, like with any advance, there are good uses and there are abuses. Just like the invention of the knife had great benefits for humanity, but also it could be used as a weapon. Likewise with firearms, likewise with nuclear energy. So with any technological advance, you got to take into account human sin.
Okay, so he added right last minute, but it's too late right now. So maybe you can come back to it. Or maybe, Jonathan, you can ask the second part of it. He was specifying energy/climate solutions for that. But we can,
I think. Yeah, that'll be a little bit long. So we'll save that one. And hey, if they want to bring it up on the web meeting, that's fine too. What I'm going to do now is, we're going to stop the webinar. Well, what I'm going to do is share a screen again so that you can see the URL. Let me pop it back here. Here we go. This is the URL for those of you who got time to join us in the web meeting. Same URL I've been using in past weeks. You can write this down. It's also posted at theparadoxes.org. And I think, Jamie, you usually put it in the chat feature. So, please join our chat meeting if you've got time, or our Zoom meeting. And once you're in, you'll be put into a waiting room. Give me a minute to move you from the waiting room into the meeting. But once you're in the meeting, you can turn your microphone on, your camera on, and start introducing yourselves to one another. And then we're going to do a little role play where I'm going to ask you to tell a real story, not a fake story, but a real story of a recent encounter that you had where you had a meaningful spiritual conversation and just how God was able to use that. So that's what's going to happen. And we'll meet for about 20, 25 minutes in the web meeting. And hey, once we go to actual in-person meetings, we're going to be able to have real fellowship. And, we started these at the beginning of the pandemic. I was showing you pictures of the treats table we had. But once we go for real, you're actually going to be able to eat the treats and not just see them virtually. So again, hopefully next time I'm back, we'll be able to give you an announcement. So with that, let me stop the share feature. And we'll end the meeting, and I'll start up the web, end the webinar and start up the web meeting.